Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with singer-songwriter Elizabeth Moen. But first, last year, when Marvel's Black Panther was released, it was heralded by many as a breakthrough moment in Hollywood. A black superhero supported by an incredible black cast, Africans and African Americans portrayed in a positive light on the big screen. This year, we've heard similar conversations about Us by Jordan Peele, a rising black director bringing a groundbreaking black horror movie to the big screen. And this hour, we're going to talk about black popular culture, high culture, and fans with Alfred Martin Jr. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. He's giving a talk this afternoon called Fandom While Black, Misty Copeland, Black Panther, Tyler Perry, and the Contours of Black Fandoms, 3:45 this afternoon at the Becker Communication Studies building on the University of Iowa campus. Alfred, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And I want to start with that phrase, black fandom. What do you mean when you say that?
Generally speaking, fandom studies is something that largely is traced back to studies in the early 90s to 2000s, where folks were looking at fandoms, and particularly looking at fandoms of things like Star Trek. And so a number of those early fandoms really were focused on, in some ways, reclaiming the black nerd, and I'm sorry, the white nerd, rather, and talking about sort of these folks as not as these social pariahs, but as these folks who were really interested and loved things like Star Trek and Star Wars, to be honest. And so when I talk about black fandom, what I'm really interested in is a lot of those early studies were focused on whiteness, and they very much talked about regret about not looking at black fandoms. And so me and certainly a number of other scholars before me have really wanted to talk about, well, how does blackness and fandom operate, and in what ways is it similar, and what ways does it depart? And so when I talk about black fandoms, I really want to talk about how are black fandoms interacting with their objects of love, and in some ways with Tyler Perry, their objects of derision.
Well, okay, let's talk about Black Panther because, you know, as I mentioned, it came out last year. All of this hype, the movie was wildly popular, Oscar winning. You know, so much of it was talked about in this new way. You know, this is a new kind of film. We're seeing if we can have a black superhero in the United States in 2018. When you looked at that moment, given your personal experience, but also your professional knowledge, what did you think about all those conversations that were going on?
They are conversations that generally tend to always happen around big media or big black media, as it were, because black media generally holds so much promise and so much weight in terms of how these texts will not only circulate within broader popular culture, but also how they will circulate industrially. And so that's one of the things that's really interesting about black fandoms, is that fandoms, particularly around things like Black Panther and also around Tyler Perry and the ballerina Misty Copeland, was really rooted in this understanding of, or we could also argue a misunderstanding of, how the culture industries operate. And so the belief and the hope was that if Black Panther was just so successful, or if Misty Copeland is so successful, or if Tyler Perry's films are so successful, it will lead to additional films being black cast films and black ballerinas and black television programs. It will lead to more production of those things. So largely, this is not a new phenomenon, even as we like to, particularly contemporarily, but I would perhaps argue throughout history, we really are interested in like firsts and groundbreaking things. But I tend to for my own research and my own fandom in some ways. I trace this moment back to 1978 at least with the film The Wiz, which was a big budget conceptualized blockbuster that was made for, depending on where you look, between $23 and $25 million. And many of the reviews of it in Black press and a lot of the discourse in Black press in particular was very much about, if we just show up and if we just demonstrate to Hollywood that we want to see these kinds of Black cast films, which of course were different than the films that came out of the early 70s with Blaxploitation, or at least what we call Blaxploitation, if we just show up and we patronize these kinds of films, we can actually get more of these kinds of films and more of Hollywood's investment in telling our stories.
And The Wiz, of course, was a retelling of The Wizard of Oz with some of the biggest names in music. And
yeah, so Diana Ross, right. Michael Jackson in his first and criminally only big screen film. Nipsey Russell was really big at the time, as was Ted Ross and Richard Pryor and Lena Horne. So the list, it was literally a cavalcade of Black stars, and in particular, Black stars that had resonance in both Black popular culture, but also in white/mainstream popular culture.
Now, when you're talking about how people felt about The Wiz and about seeing this kind of film supporting a box office or supporting the success, I'm hearing a difference between these Star Trek, Star Wars fandoms that we talk about and this idea of Black fandom, where there was this, and maybe is this, kind of feeling of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I don't care so much if I like this or if I don't like this. I need to go see this and support this because of what it means for the culture.
Right, exactly. So in my research, what I call it is this civic duty. And so we see it in things like The Wiz, but we also see it in Tyler Perry's media output. So, for instance, I talked to both folks who were fans of Tyler Perry's work as well as people who did not like his work. Even the folks who did not like his work said things like, well, you know what? I should support this because if we just show that there's a Black consumer, then maybe we can shift the kinds of things that we see. So with Black Panther, if we sort of fast forward to Black Panther was very similar in the sense that it was very much about, I am not a Marvel fan, I do not go see superhero movies, but gosh darn it, I am going to show up and I'm going to see Black Panther. And in particular, many of them, so it wasn't even, for Black Panther, wasn't even just about the consumption. It was actually about the consumption on opening weekend. Because obviously we know that opening weekend becomes really a really important industrial tool to talk about how a film is going to perform. And so for many of the folks that I talked to, they had to go and they had to go on opening weekend because, as one of the folks I interviewed said, we want this film to get credit for making that statement. So it is very much representational in, oh my God, we've got this Black superhero, but it is also political in the sense that it is, we've got this Black superhero and we are showing up and showing up with our dollars. So it becomes very, in some ways, very 1960s civil rights movement, talking about the ways that we connect consumerism to activism.
Interesting. Well, there also seems to be this disconnect between the actual reality of the Black audience and the perception of the Black audience. I mean, we all heard those questions. Can a giant Black blockbuster be successful? But the audience has been there, right? I mean,
right.
This is not,
right.
It doesn't actually seem like that big a question.
Right. And I mean, what is really fascinating is that, you know, the culture industries in some ways are an inherently race-based, if not racist, industry. And so, you know, whiteness in many ways sells. And so if we see a Tom Cruise film, or at least a Tom Cruise film in the 90s that failed, a Tom Cruise failed movie is not necessarily about, oh, well, like, you know, nobody wants to see Tom Cruise in a movie.
Or maybe white people don't want to go to these films.
Right. Or like, you know, or white folks are like, white folks hate Tom Cruise or whatever it is.
Right.
But when we talk about, if we go back to The Wiz, part of what The Wiz sort of demonstrated was this idea that presumably black films, black audiences were not there for that film, which was patently false. But also that it somehow demonstrated that black cast films were not something that people wanted to see. And so blackness.
Anybody, black or white.
Right, right, right. So blackness becomes this thing, and particularly black cast film. And if we talk about even Misty Copeland, for instance, the idea of a black cast film failing or Misty Copeland failing means that everything black that comes after it fails as well. Whiteness just gets to fail, and it's just like, oh, well, shrug. Like, let's like
that
let's
was
do
maybe
this other.
Just a bad movie.
Yeah, like, yeah. So it's just, you know, it's just a bad movie. But, you know, blackness becomes in some ways industrially pathological.
Right. Now, of course, we know that Black Panther succeeded and succeeded with all kinds of audiences. Mm-hmm. Do you, it may be too soon to tell, do you feel like that really was and is a watershed moment?
I think it is a watershed moment for Marvel. I think it was a watershed moment for the industry. I don't think it's a watershed moment for blackness in media, because the industry always sort of has this kind of amnesia. And so the next time that, you know, so if we talk about Black Panther and then we talk about Us, for instance, mm-hmm. Yeah, the next time that there is a big film, it'll be like it's the first time all over again.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking to Alfred Martin Jr. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. He's giving a talk this afternoon called Fandom While Black, Misty Copeland, Black Panther, Tyler Perry, and the Contours of Black Fandoms. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Alfred Martin Jr. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. We are talking about black fandom, black popular culture, black high culture, culture in general. He's giving a talk this afternoon called Fandom While Black, Misty Copeland, Black Panther, Tyler Perry, and the Contours of Black Fandoms at 3:45 this afternoon at the Becker Communication Studies building at the University of Iowa. Okay, let's connect the dots. We were talking about Black Panther before the break. This huge movie, wildly successful, seen by many as a watershed moment. You don't think necessarily that that's true, because we seem to have this amnesia where we forget about a wildly successful black film and then wonder all over again, can one be successful? So we talked about The Wiz back in the late 1970s. I want to talk about Spike Lee a little bit. You've mentioned Tyler Perry a lot and his films, which are often critically panned, beloved by some, but obviously a very successful career. Let's talk about Spike Lee, because his films often critically lauded and often very political, making some really strong statements. Where does he fit into this idea of fandom and the mainstream pop culture?
So I think in some ways, Spike Lee is, you know, I would argue at least, Spike Lee is a, you know, filmmaker with a capital F, in the sense that he is one of the filmmakers who come into Hollywood on this wave of sort of pedigree, because in large part in the 70s and 80s in particular, many of the folks who were working in film were folks who just sort of learned the craft. Spike Lee and folks like him are part of this wave that come out of film schools, where they are sort of classically, and I put that in quotes, classically trained through the academy in filmmaking. So Spike Lee, in some ways, comes through with a kind of a pedigree already, because he is sort of has the seal of approval of
an
NYU
artist, yeah.
as an artist. And Spike Lee also, in many ways, ushers in the 1990s what we call New Black Cinema. And so what Spike Lee is doing is still sort of regarded within notions of fandom. But in some ways, and I don't know how this happened, but Spike Lee's moment was kind of the 1990s. And then the kind of fandom and the kind of urgency around his films in the 2000s. So if we look at Chirac and I can't remember the name of the other one that was more recent. But with Chirac, there was not necessarily that kind of feeling that we had to go to see it. So it was more kind of one of those films that was an art house film.
Okay.
Black Klansman
right,
is the other
yeah.
one I
which
was thinking about.
Which, of course,
about.
He received
yeah, which,
an Oscar for.
Yeah, which he deserved an overdue Oscar. And, of course, I don't, you know, in Iowa City in particular, it was at Film Scene. So it was very much a small film.
An art house type.
Yeah, and
of
so those
yeah.
films tend to be lauded as art. And they aren't necessarily called upon to do anything for the ways that the industry right. thinks about blackness.
Since they're not mainstream anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. And so what's so important and visceral about what happens with an Us, a Black Panther, and with Tyler Perry's films is that they have these wide releases. And so because of these wide releases, they need to not only perform, but they actually have to overperform because the assumption is that they will not perform.
Interesting. And we've mentioned Us a couple of times. Let's talk about it just a little bit. Us by Jordan Peele. And of course, he had a tremendous success with the movie Get Out, which also had, you know, it brought up some really interesting conversations about race. But Us is considered to be a black film.
Mm-hmm.
So a black horror film, no less. Mm-hmm. Why do people think that's so groundbreaking? What is opening eyes with this?
Well, I think blackness within particularly film and sort of broad-based films that are supposed to be successful is largely rooted in, on one hand, historical fiction or historical biopics. It's also generally rooted within comedy. And so because those are the ways in which the industry seems to sort of pump their money, what is important about something like Us is that it is not a comedy, presumably, or for Get Out as well. These are not comedies. And these are large-scale films with sizable budgets that pull in box office dollars. And so what's interesting and important, I would argue, about those films is that they are in some ways not adhering to the script mm-hmm. of the spaces in which film blackness or cinematic blackness is supposed to be successful.
So like a black superhero movie. Also a black
exactly.
horror movie.
Exactly. So these are, yeah, so, you know, if it's, you know, Girls Trip, for instance, which was extraordinarily funny, I thought. But that film in some ways is expected in terms mm-hmm. of success because we in many ways think of black folks as funny. Or, you know, or something like Ray or 12 Years a Slave, because these are these historical pictures that re-excavate civil rights history and sort of black music and culture history, those films do well. If we go back to the early 2000s or the mid 2000s, I think it was, with Dreamgirls, that's a film that is about, you know, music and, you know, music and dancing. And so those films feed into a particular kind of trope of expected blackness in film.
Fascinating. Well, all right. Speaking of unexpected, when I read the name of your talk, Fandom While Black, Misty Copeland, Black Panther, Tyler Perry, and the Contours of Black Fandoms, I thought, why are we talking about Misty Copeland with Black Panther and Tyler Perry movies. So now, for people who are not dance fans, Misty Copeland, back in 2015, not very long ago, became the first African-American woman to be promoted to principal dancer in the American Ballet Theatre's 75-year history. And of course, she is extraordinary. So why are we pulling high culture in with our conversation about pop culture? What does Misty Copeland mean?
So on one hand, she's extraordinarily fascinating because she, and I am not certain whether she does it or if the discourse around her does it, but it participates in a similar kind of historical forgetting that the industry, the film industry participates in. So that, you know, when you read what Misty Copeland's achievement is, there are all these wonderful qualifiers. So it's, you know, the first African-American female in this particular company, at this particular rank. And so in some ways, it works at a kind of erasure of Black ballet history. So so we certainly, in some ways, those who are connected to dance, really, you know, we will know about folks like Arthur Mitchell from New York City Ballet. We may know about Albert Evans from New York City Ballet, but in terms of women, that history is more more invisible. And so people like Raven Wilkinson, people like Lauren Johnson from, or Lauren Anderson rather, from Houston Ballet, people like Deborah Austin from New York City Ballet get lost in translation. And so what I was really interested in, though, is the ways that that moniker about her being the first African-American woman promoted to principal dancer with American Ballet Theatre, the ways that it actually got taken up by Black folks was really fascinating to me.
Interesting. And I should mention, you are a dancer and a choreographer. You teach ballet at Nolte Academy of Dance and Music in Coralville, but
yes,
you've been involved in,
yes,
in dance for a very long time at a high level. So even though you are of the dance world, you were noticing that Misty Copeland transcends the dance world.
Correct. And so I was really interested because I was seeing a number of my friends in social media talking about, oh my God, like, have you heard about this woman, Misty Copeland? And she's amazing. And what I was simultaneously interested in is not only the discourse around her, but also this idea that, and this sounds extraordinarily snooty, and I recognize that, but like the idea that people who had no knowledge of ballet were sort of, you know, proclaiming her the second coming of ballet.
Right.
And in many ways,
they're not fans of ballet. They're fans of Misty Copeland.
Right. And they're, yeah, right, so they're fans of her. And so in many ways, this discourse was sort of pushing her along such that probably 4 years before she was promoted, Kevin McKenzie, the director of American Ballet Theatre, essentially said, I don't think Misty Copeland is yet ready to be a principal dancer in this company. And there was outrage because for her fans, she was the greatest thing. And in fact, her pointe shoes, her dead pointe shoes sell for, if I'm remembering correctly, her dead pointe shoes, and she signs them, sell for about $100. Other ballerinas in the company sell for about 40 or 50. Huh. So we see sort of the ways that these economies of fandom function. And so that was actually why I was really interested in her. And so what works across Misty Copeland and Tyler Perry and Black Panther is that there is this same civic duty, this same notion that Black folks, instead of spending, you know, $10 to go to the Cineplex, are spending $80 to go to the theater to see Misty Copeland, because if we just show up, then it will encourage American Ballet Theatre and other ballet theaters across the country, in an era when folks are disinvesting in ballet anyway, it will encourage this new Black patronage of ballet.
And you were talking to the same people about their fandom of Misty Copeland as you were talking about their fandom of Tyler Perry.
I mean, correct.
That's really interesting,
correct,
to me.
Correct. So, you know, so these fandoms in some ways are certainly object specific, But they're also, like, they're also rooted in this universal blackness and this universal hunger for more blackness in more places, and particularly in places, in some ways, particularly with Misty Copeland and Black Panther, in spaces where it's, quote, not supposed to be. So Misty Copeland is great because she's in not only a ballet company, but is in, or a dance company rather, but in a ballet company, and not just a ballet company, but American Ballet Theater, which is understood by those outside of ballet as, like, this is the company that represents America. Mm-hmm. And New York City Ballet, which, you know, shares performance space in Lincoln Center with them, is understood as a ballet company of the city, and by those who don't have that knowledge would be like a step down for her.
Now, you talked about how we get amnesia about, you know, big black films or, you know, great works of art, and we forget, and then we ask again, can we do this? But it has to, the children growing up now, or anybody looking up at the screen and seeing someone who looks like them, that who resonates with them, who really represents them, there have to be, that there's an impact there that can't be broken down by box office. I mean, that has to be creating change culturally, don't you think?
I mean, I think perhaps. I think it remains to be seen in some ways, you know, anecdotally at least. Several folks talked about how one woman in particular talked about how important Black Panther was for her nephew. Lots of folks talked about how they were planning to get Black Panther costumes for their children for Halloween. And so we could argue that that has some semblance of impact. You know, for one woman I talked to specifically about Misty Copeland, she was saying that Copeland made her feel visible even as she was someone who danced. But she never saw anyone who looked like her necessarily in her ballet classes and in the ballet world. So in some ways, we could argue that it does have an impact. And in many ways, I'm interested only tertiarily in that impact, but I'm really very much interested in its impacts on the ways that the media industries, and I'm sort of subsuming ballet into this, mm-hmm. how they respond to these notions of black fandom and sort of black demand for more. And so, you know, there's another African-American man, Calvin Harris, who's in, he's a soloist with American Ballet Theater. A number of companies like Block, which is the maker of dancewear, they somewhat recently had an ad campaign in which they had a black boy in their ad. There's also a company, and I can't remember if it's Block or if it's Gaynor Minden, but they make point shoes, and they are now doing point shoes in different colors,
not just
pink. To match other skin tones. Whereas, you know, black ballerinas and black ballet dancers, myself included, you know, when I had to, you know, wear something that was supposed to be flesh tone, I had to sit with my white ballet shoes and I had to use, you know, foundation and just like color them until they were my skin tone.
Wow.
And so that was a kind of labor that white dancers didn't have to do.
I mentioned you teach ballet now.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that for some of your students, having a black male ballet teacher has to be powerful. Do you think about what it would have been like? Did you ever have a black ballet teacher when you were growing up?
I had black dance teachers, but not ballet teachers, I don't think. I did not have a black ballet teacher. I had black modern dance teachers, and that was about it. So presumably, I would imagine that for particularly my students of color, that feels that feels good. I mean, I think it also, I've had students in university settings tell me that it feels good to actually see a professor who looks, at least phenotypically, looks like them mm-hmm. in the classroom. One student is a senior, I have her this semester, and she said in her 4 years at the University of Iowa, I'm the first African-American professor she's had. And she said she specifically took my class because she's like, before I leave here, I'm going to do this thing.
And that's powerful for her, but it's powerful for all your students, mm-hmm. I have to imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I would. I at least like to imagine that it is powerful for them.
Alfred Martin Jr. is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. He is also a ballet teacher and choreographer with Nolte Academy of Dance and Music in Coralville. Up next, singer-songwriter Elizabeth Moen. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.